that you are doing something other than sitting there going, what the hell are we doing? Right? You should internalize whenever... Master Sun Yun used to always say, because we didn't speak Chinese, and he didn't speak Mandarin, so 90% of his own congregation he couldn't communicate with. He had to have translators even for the Chinese. And he used to always say, if you don't know what's going on, internalize. Go to the inner temple if you don't know what's happening around you. Never waste a moment just sitting there going, wow, I guess I'm just going to wait until something I know pops up. Don't ever do that. If you have no idea what's happening, go inside. This is true in every situation, not just in the temple. If you're in a business meeting or you're in some kind of a situation where you find that in your environment, you're kind of like, I have no idea what's going on. Go in. It's a prime opportunity to be now. Go in. Always go in. If in the case where we're doing a mantra like that, you go, hey, I know that one, then jump right into it. Then all of a sudden another one comes up, you're like, I've never even heard that mantra. Go back in. So what were we doing? I wanted to demonstrate beyond just the Sunday service, because the Sunday service, this is not the only service out there. There's millions, literally millions, of different kinds of services. There are devotional services. There are the contemplative. There's like this one, which even tells you at the top. This is a meditation and sutra practice. That's what kind of puja this is. There's also offering pujas, where everything's very elaborate. Like, our offerings are not elaborate in this. They may look like it, but they're not at all. I mean, the mandala ceremonies are gigantic, where everybody builds mandalas the whole time they're doing the mandala ceremony. And they're drawn out, and they're like 8 pages long, just for the mandala. So there's all different types. The mantra and the singing is a meditative and devotional puja. Something we have to be very, very careful of is that we don't allow the Dharma, the Buddha Dharma, or the Buddha himself, or the Sangha, to become some kind of a sterile religious thing. It should never, ever be that. Don't wear a top knot in front of me. What are you doing?
Not a top knot.
Well, I'm curling around. Don't do that. No better than that. So, you have to be aware that all of these teachings and everything that we're trying to do in the Sunday service, everything we're trying to do in the classes, Dharma talks, all of it, the whole thing is all supposed to just be supporting your direct, immediate experience of the three jewels. It's supposed to support your direct experience of the Buddhist teachings and you applying them. The application of the Buddhist teachings, and this is going to be very, very hard for us to learn in the West. The application, if you don't hear anything else that I say, listen to this very, very carefully. Please, this is super important. The application of Dharma is not a legalistic, theistic, or any other kind of istic. It's not a thing for you to apply because you have to, because you call yourself Buddhist. It's not something that you do because you took refuge and now you're obligated. No. The application of Dharma has one purpose. One purpose. Joy. The whole point is the liberation, the freedom from the slavery of suffering. Dharma and all of the teachings and all of the practices and all the vows and all of this, and I gotta do that, and I gotta do this thing with my hands, and I gotta do that, and all that, and memorize this and that, and if you fetter yourself with that, you rob yourself of the joy that all of it is meant to give. I mean, we came to Buddhism because the Buddha says, look, suffering, it blows. It totally sucks. Don't do it anymore. And we go, well, isn't that the point, right? That's, we don't want to. And he says, fine, then don't. Here's how. And stop. Here's the way you do it. Now knock it off. So what do? We approach the Buddha, and sorry if this offends, but it's true in our culture, in the West here. Especially Americans. Our problem is, we come to the Buddha, we come to his teachings, the Buddha Dharma, and we come to the community he established, the Sangha, like we come to Jesus Christ. We have to or we burn. That's how we approach that. That's why you guys aren't in the churches. You're looking for something that you can do without coercion. You don't want a terrorist threat in order to become devotional. Oh, love me or you're going to burn in hell. You know, that's a terrible relationship. I'm not attacking Christianity. I'm attacking everything that we approach like that. The Dharma's not like that. The Dharma will never condemn you. The only thing the Dharma ever says is, look, if you don't like your own habit, here's something new that you can try. That's all. Some people have habits and they don't bother them. That's called God realm. They're not bothered by their habits. So Buddha says, leave them alone. They don't need the Dharma. They will later, but not right now. So we leave them alone. They're great. They're fine. They are totally happy. That's the God realm. You can be totally happy. There's other beings that are completely miserable. So miserable they can't hear the Dharma. That's all those lower realms. They won't even get through to them because they... It is completely here for your satisfaction. Huh? How do you like that term? The Dharma is here for your satisfaction. Of course, your ego goes, yoo-hoo! That's not what we exactly mean. But then again, it is. The Buddha calls samsara dissatisfaction. When you live in a realm of dissatisfaction, it's really horrible. So he's like, I'm going to give you something that satisfies. Doing devotional practices allows you to engage that. We're not supposed to be sterile. All the music and noise that we're supposed to be doing during the offerings, those are supposed to be votive offerings. Votive, we talked about that last night. That's why I'm saying it. It's not because I'm smart. It's just because it came up in class last night. Anybody know what, not you guys, do you know what votive means? Anyone? Generally, people like to go, yeah, those little candles. You're right, but there's a reason why they call the candle a votive. Votive means a very personal and meaningful offering. That's what it means. Now, before Christianity came and conquered the rest of the world, we were all pretty well off doing a thing called paganism, or whatever natural religion, shamanism. You know, we were just in tune with nature. And one of the key things that we would do, because we're all poor, generally, you know, because we just live in huts and plow fields. That's it. We didn't have to build cities. That wasn't until, you know, some guy comes along in a pointy hat and says, I need a building so f***ing big that we can't even use like 90% of it. And I need you to build it. Then we start building cathedrals. Before that, we didn't need anything. Not like that. So we were poor. Even in the Buddha's day, this is totally true. Oil was very expensive for a lamp. And you didn't waste it. When the sun went down, you waited till the last minute possible before you would light that lamp. So here's one of the things that we would do. In order to show our devotion to the divine or to nature or to protectors or whatever kinds of things that we were approaching, the Buddhas, the different gods in Hinduism, you would take some of that very precious oil that you worked very hard to purchase, and you would make a little lamp out of it, and you would offer that oil and that light to the divine. Well, the Christians saw that and went, oh, yeah, we're so, huh? You're going to do that with us now. That's how they came up with the votive candle. That's what that is. When we make offerings in the Sunday service, they're supposed to be votive. So you pick up the instrument and you're supposed to just have a heart bursting with joy that you're giving this and getting to engage it. Because when you ring a bell, if you guys don't know this, when you ring a bell or you play a drum, the dakinis, the sky dancers, the assistants to the gurus and buddhas dance and laugh and go crazy all through the atmosphere. And they shower buddhas and bodhisattvas with flowers and with all of these mystical offerings when we play music with a joyous heart. So we're supposed to be engaging in that. So when you start to play, you go, ha-ha, guess what I'm going to do? Woo-hoo! I'm showering all the Buddhas. If you have the feeling like, well, I have to do the offering because it's in this sadhana, and, you know, the puja makes us, and when we come to that part, I'll ring my bell, you know, and I'll wait for us to get to the Dharma talk or the sutra or the chanting, whatever it is that's your favorite part, or maybe the closing prayer, and be like, I'm getting the hell out of here, I did my time, I'm out. There's no joy in that, which means you're not engaging in the joy of Dharma. Generally, when that happens, we as teachers, as the Sangha, perceive two problems. One, you're not internalizing the underlying meaning of this whole process. You're not recognizing that you're being released from the penitentiary. It's very rare to find an inmate on the day he's released who's not happy about it. I knew a guy that he worked in a prison. And I mean, you're not going to see people go, man, they're going to kick me out of San Quentin. This is a crime. Why are they throwing me out of here? No one's going to do that. In fact, they count the minutes on when they can get out. Dharma should be like that for you. Whoo, I'm done with this suffering. That crap is over. I'm not doing it anymore. Even if it pops up, I'm not its slave. Favorite quote from a teacher that I really like is, he talks about fear all the time. He goes, fear and I are brothers, and I'm the elder. Meaning I'm the older brother who beats it up all the time. Here to abolish hope and fear. That's kind of my thing. I'm here to destroy all your fear and destroy all your hope, because both of those are a waste of your time. The second thing is, if we see that you're not engaging in the joy of Dharma, if it's not that you haven't internalized this aspect of it, which maybe you are, and maybe you're recognizing the underlying pattern, the other issue is you have not yet had the direct immediate experience of the bliss state in the meditation. So you have not tasted what bliss feels like. You have not come in direct contact with your actual nature. So your true nature is a blissed out nature. I mean a seriously blissed out nature. Like the kind that drools and can't even think of itself, kind of. Nature. It's not that it's dumb, it's just, wow, there's nothing that's going to touch it. And if you haven't found that in your meditation, that'll also keep joy from arising. The only people that are not allowed, and it's even sketchy at that, is monks are not allowed to dance and sing and engage in music. Although, even after the Buddha gave that teaching, he gave the teaching to a whole bunch of monks to play music. So he had a whole group of monks that would, like, you know, play lutes, and they would play their flute, and they'd play all these different instruments, and they'd sing and dance, you know, all kinds of dharmic songs to the Buddha and stuff like that, and the Buddha would be like, you know, go hang out with them and raise your spirits. Do not allow yourself to be moody and depressed and low. That's the whole point of mantra. Mantra is supposed to short circuit that long, grueling, sitting there going, when am I going to get bliss? If you're not good at sitting,
Do mantra.
Mantra short circuits that, especially if you start singing it. To your own melody. And if you're one of those people that can do it, you can go to a park and start dancing while you're singing. Of course, everybody think you're a Hare Krishna, but hey, that's what they're doing. They got it. They know. They're not stupid. Bhagavad Gita is very clear about how to create devotion in order to relieve yourself of gloominess. So today we did all kinds of mantra. We started out with the Dharani of Great Compassion. Then we did Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra. Then we went to Avalokitesvara. Or no?
I think we did Manjushri.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, then we did Manjushri Bodhisattva. We did his mantra. Then Avalokitesvara's mantra. Then we did the Heart Sutra, the Gate mantra, which is actually the mantra of Prajna Paramita, great perfect wisdom. Then we had Vajrasattva Bodhisattva, which was a purifying mantra to purify all negativities. Then after that, we had Amitabha, who is actually our Buddha. If you guys didn't know that, you know, because Shakyamuni's like, once I'm out, I'm out. The only thing that will be left is my footprint of the sutra. But the living, active Buddha in our realm here that presides over us today is Amitabha Buddha. He's not incarnate. He lives in the astral realm and appears only in the form of gurus. So we did his mantra because that's the Buddha of the West. Who do we have after
Vajrasattva and Ganesh. The last one was Ganesh.
Yeah, we did Ganesh. I thought there was somebody after Vajrasattva. Or did we just go right into...
It was Avalokiteshvara. Oman Padme Hum, that one.
Well, that's Avalokiteshvara. I don't think we went back to that. I know we did... Maybe we just did Vajrasattva, went to Amitabha, and then did Ganesha.
You had it down to Avalokiteshvara. You did something while you were chanting, and I heard Avalokiteshvara several times.
That was the beginning, I think.
Oh, yeah. That's the Dharani of Great Compassion. And of course, everybody, Ganesha, I thought that's Hinduism. No, Ganesha is in Buddhism. Actually, big time. Two of my gurus, that's their main idioms. That's who they use for their personal protectors, just like Shiva. We're not separate from all of those Hindu deities. Depending on what sect of Buddhism you're in, the more prevalent they are. Like Sarasvati is huge in the Chinese. They just don't call her that. So we ended with a Ganesha mantra. Hopefully the drumming and the singing was all to raise that positive energy. At one point, some of the folks up here in Minnesota started doing it in the kirtan style, where they were singing after my verse. That's also super helpful, especially if you don't know the mantra. That's a good way to learn it. And we're never going to give you a mantra, you know, that's harmful. We're not going to like start doing angelic mantras that are worthless. It's always going to be mantras that are very positive and connected to sutra, for sure. But I wanted to present this so that you can let yourself expand and, more than anything, relax. Don't come to Buddhism the way that you attended your other religious practices, because it's not about the institution at all. You come to hear Dharma. It's for you personally. Whether it's a room full of people or you're the only one in the room, a Dharma talk is specifically for you. And you take it and apply it with this idea of the same way, like a person would go to their beloved parent or whoever their mentor is and say, "Wow, I really need help with that." And they say, "Well, here you go." And they go, "Oh, such a relief. I could get that, talk about that and get that taken care of." That's how the approach should be. Never, "Oh, I got to work that in now?" If that's how you feel, then you don't need to. No, don't do that. 84,000 teachings, you only need one, maybe two or three, at the most. But those are for you to decide which ones to do. I was almost going to just have us do mantra and sit for the entire service and then give this talk at the end. But I chose to approach it this way. And I wasn't, it was not my intent at the beginning of service. I got here early and I did the Dharani of Great Compassion. And then I just was like, screw it. This is what we're going to do. I moved to just do that. The secret there, my title, Nagpa, I don't know if you guys know that, but I'm a Nagpa. Nagpa means a mantra speaker, somebody who's ordained in, in that whole world of mantra, they're like the go-to guys for mantra. So of course, when we get to mantra, that's when I shine. That's my thing. That's what I do. Which is why I like the Dharani and all that. So we're not going to do offerings because we did them. At least I did. I offered music and song and playing the instrument and intention and all of that stuff. There's no sutra to do because we sang all of the sutra by reciting the mantras. Of course, you go, but I didn't hear any words of Buddha. No, but your soul did. Because heart-mind transmission doesn't use the ear. It goes right into the third eye consciousness and into heart consciousness. And if you recited any of the mantra with me, then it also got throat consciousness. In those three places. So you got it. And here's your Dharma talk. So I'm ending. We're going to do closing prayer. And I think there is class today. Is that correct?
There's class today.
All right. So I guess you guys have some time to do something before you find out if anyone shows up for class or not.
No.
An hour. Go get some coffee. At least that's my thing. I know some of you are not coffee people, but I am a diehard coffee person. I think Ganesha was absolutely genius when he came up with the idea of a coffee plant. That was brilliant. I give him big props for that. I put my Mala away before... It was ready.